Rabbi Alefki. Thank you very much, Rabbi, for those warm feelings of abandonment. And brings back memories of my youth. But I used to have guys who would sit in my class and they'd say, Rabbi, I may have to leave early. I hope you don't mind if I walk out. I said, as long as you don't stand up and say, I've had enough of this first, and then storm out. I mean, just leave by twos and threes. That would be fine. But I handle rejection on a regular basis. I have 11 children. In any event, so, no, but now they get older and you have a much better relationship because they realize they need your money. But it's certainly a pleasure for me to be back here in Atlanta where, even if people don't get my jokes, they laugh anyway because people are pleasant and very, very polite, and I do appreciate that. And this is, of course, my first time here in the beautiful community of Dunwoody. And, they always say that the name of anything helps to reveal the essence of it, so that, for example, Poland was seen as the words Polan, here we will reside. And the Jews lived there for close to 1,000 years, America was observed to be Am Reka, an empty nation. This is what someone passed on to me once. British are the people of the continent, the Commonwealth, which is very interesting. And this is obviously a community where everything is accomplished with chokhma and with wisdom because it's done witty. So, thank you very much. I have nothing else to do with that joke, so you can keep it if you like, pass it around. In any event, I want to talk about a topic this evening that I think is so incredibly essential, and it is so simple and basic, and in general, you should know that the easier the questions, the harder they are to answer. And that's why little children are so incredibly frustrating, because they ask easy questions, and we don't know how to answer easy questions. We have been trained to answer compound, complex questions based on many assumptions. I, of course, am like a small child in many ways. When I was learning in yeshiva by Rav Tzvi Kushelevsky, I was certainly not among the greatest of the students that were there. I was quite simple. But whenever I would go over to one of the rabbis to ask a question, they would get that nervous look that rabbis get when you're coming over to ask them something they don't want to answer, and they're trying to quickly think of an irrelevant story that would hopefully push you off. So that's what they teach us in rabbi school. In any event, so I come over, I see him getting nervous, and finally I said to him, why do you always get nervous when I come over? And he says, Alofsky, you make me nervous. You ask easy questions. Easy questions are very hard to answer. Hard questions are easy to answer because they're already built on so many different assumptions. But the simpler the question, the more basic it is, the harder it is to answer, which is why it's unfortunate that so few people can answer basic questions, simple questions. And I want to ask the simplest question that I possibly can this evening. And I want to introduce it with a verse from the Torah. We all know that the Torah is divided up into parshios, and the first two parshios, Bereishis and Noach, basically deal with world history before the Jews come onto the scene. Lech Lecha is the beginning of Jewish history where Abraham, the first Jew, is introduced. But he makes a cameo appearance at the end of Parshas Noach. There are 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, and he's the last one over there, so he's tossed in. We hear about his family. His father, Terach, it says, had 3 sons, Avram, Nachor, and Haran. And Haran dies, here's the language in the verse, Al Pnei Terach Aviv. He dies on his father's face. I'm assuming that's not literal, because it would be very messy if you died on your father's face. So the word Pnei in Hebrew, Rashi, the famous commentary from 1,000 years ago, takes it in 2 directions. He either learns it as Lifnei or Mipnei. He died, Alpnei means he died before his father, in the lifetime of his father. Or he died Mipnei, he died because of his father. And to explain this, Rashi brings a medrash from 2,000 years ago that tells a famous Bible story that probably all of us remember learning as children if we had, you know, some Jewish education. And that is the story of the early years of Abraham, which the Torah leaves out. The Torah alludes to it in this half a verse. That's it. The Torah opens up, Abraham is 75, God tells him to go on a journey to the Holy Land, right? But these are the early years of Abraham. Abraham's father was an idol worshiper, but he wasn't merely an idol worshiper. He manufactured gods. That's what he did for a living. How's business? Thank God. You know what I mean? I take a living. And this is what you'd go to Terach for if you needed a god. You wanted a money god. You wanted a love god. You wanted a basketball god. He would make you a god to order, and everybody had their own individual gods. Now, Abraham is looking around the store, and he says, how can this one be God, and this one be God, and this one be God? They can't all be God. There must be one all-powerful God. He came up with monotheism. Unbelievable. But from a more pragmatic point of view, this is going to be bad for business. So how do you explain this to your father, right? So he waits till Terach goes to a God convention and leaves Abraham in charge of the shop, and he takes a big hammer and he walks around and he smashes all the idols except one big guy, sticks the hammer in his hand, sits down at the table, minds his own business, waits for his father to come home. His father comes home, finds his business has been destroyed. He says, Abraham, what did you do to me? He says, Dad, it wasn't me. He said, what do you mean it wasn't me? He says, oh, you should have seen it. All the gods started fighting. This one said, I'm the most powerful. This one said, I'm the most powerful. And the big guy there said, yeah, I'll show you. And he took the hammer and he smashed everybody. So Terach says, Abraham, what are you talking about? They can't talk and they can't move. And Abraham, being the first Jew, extended his thumb and said, if they can't talk and they can't move, then why do you pray to them? A devastating theological question. What would any responsible parent do if their child asked them a devastating theological question? They would take them to the evil King Nimrod. Today we put them in therapy, but the concept remains the same. And Nimrod, who is the head of all the idolaters, some of this is going to get a little too close. Anyway, and Nimrod, who is the head of all the idolatrous cults, asked Abraham the answer that adults have been asking kids for millennia. Kid, why can't you be like everybody else? Just pick a god and worship him. So he says, well, I tell you, Nimrod, there's so many to choose from, I don't know where to start. You know, how do I know? He says, well, you can pray to my god, but my god is fire. I pray to fire. He says, why? It's because fire burns and destroys everything. Fire is power, and I love power, so fire is my God. Okay? Difficult guy to get along with, yeah? So Abraham says, fire is power? Yes. Then why don't you pray to water? It's so powerful, it can put out fire. Nimrod says, okay, kid, I'm open-minded. I hear what you're saying. From now on, we're going to worship water. Everybody, we're switching from fire to water. Oh, the great water god. So he says, whoa, wait a second, Nimrod. He says, what? He says, water is power, right? He says, yes, we established that. Water is power. It's so strong it can put out fire. He says, then why don't you pray to the clouds? They're so powerful they can create water. Okay, fine. I'll pray to the clouds. Wait a second. What now? Clouds of power? Yes. Then why don't you pray to the wind? They're so powerful they can blow the clouds away. Nimrod says, okay, kid, I see where you're heading. I'm going back to fire. Right? and he builds a giant furnace. And two guys grab Abram and he says, okay, smart guy, let's see if your all-powerful, invisible God is going to save you from my God. Ha ha. And they lead him towards the fire, says the Medrash, scene change to his brother Haran, who is watching these events unfold. Because Haran has become a student of Abraham. He is also a monotheist. They do Shabbos lunch together, they sing songs, whatever the deal is. And he's looking at this and he says, uh-oh, I'm next. And they're going to ask me this question next. So Haran says in his heart, and he says, if Abram comes out of that fire alive, then I'm going to declare myself for God. But if he doesn't, I'm switching sides and going over to Nimrod, right? Okay. They take Abram, they throw him in the furnace, and a miracle. He doesn't die, his clothes don't burn, his hair doesn't singe. The crowd is very impressed. Abram, through the midst of the flame, says,
Can I come out now?
Nimrod says, fine. He comes out, brushes off a little soot, smatters him with applause. Fine. Bad day for Nimrod. So he tries again, and he says to Haran, whose side are you on? And he says, I believe in the one God. I believe in the God of Abraham. I'm a monotheist. They take him, and they put him in the fire, and he dies. That's the end. And that's what it means, al pnei terach aviv, because of his father. Now, I want to teach you one idea that I think is a very important idea, and probably one of the most essential that we can come away with this evening. There's a rule. We are not studying a verse in the Torah because we're interested in the events that happened 3,000 years ago. And we're not studying Gemara or Medrash for insights from 2,000 years ago, and we don't read Rashi for insights into 1,000 years ago. If we are studying this today, it's because it has a message that is relevant to us in the year 2009, or we would not be reading it. There's at some point in the Gemara where the Gemara is asking about something historical that took place, and the Gemara asks the question, who cares? Mada hava hava, that's history. This is not a history book. There has to be a message that's here for us today. And whenever we learn something, we have to look at it and say, if I'm performing this mitzvah, if I'm learning this pasuk, if I'm learning this Rashi, there's got to be a message for me in my life. So we look at the story, as I've told it to you, and there's an obvious question. How come Abraham declares himself for God and he throws himself into the fire and he gets a miracle, and Haran does the same exact thing and he dies? And I'm sure as I'm speaking, many ideas are occurring to you that you can probably find in the commentaries. But I was looking for an answer that spoke to us today. And I got that answer 10 years ago when I finally looked at this Rashi and I saw a new insight. I have been teaching classes on intermarriage for about 30 years. When I first started teaching classes on intermarriage, I would say to a group of young Jewish people, how many here would consider intermarriage? And a few hands would go up. As the years went by, more hands go up. When I speak to the average group of students today, all the hands go up. Consider intermarriage? Of course. In fact, 5 years ago, a poll showed that the majority of American Jews consider it racist to oppose intermarriage. Now, here I'm going to get up in front of a group of young people who may be dating non-Jewish people, whose parents might be intermarried. Certainly they have siblings or family members who are intermarried. And I'm going to get up and speak about intermarriage. It's a very emotional issue. There's a lot of emotion there. So I start giving this class. And 5 minutes into the class, when this girl bursts into tears and runs out of the room. Now, I was shocked. Because it usually takes me a half an hour before anybody bursts into tears and runs out of the room. So 5 minutes was a record. So at the end of the class, I asked her what I said that upset her so much so I could use it again. And she said, no, Rabbi, it's not you. I said, too bad. So what is it? She says, this is a very emotional issue for me right now. I said, why? She says, I come from a strong Jewish family. I said, what does that mean? I said, well, we went to synagogue on the high holidays. My mother belonged to the sisterhood. I belonged to the synagogue youth group. We had a Passover Seder. I put the electric menorah in the window on Hanukkah. A strong Jewish sense. And the one thing I always knew, Rabbi, is that I would never intermarry because my Judaism is so important to me. Fine. I went off to high school. I dated some non-Jewish boys, but I knew nothing would come of it because my Judaism is so important to me. Okay? So I went off to university. I met a nice non-Jewish boy. And we were dating for 2 years, and I fell in love. Now, of course, she doesn't say it like that. She says it like this. And then I fell in love. Now, for the benefit of the men, I'm sure the women all understand this, because you speak girl, right? But guys don't. So, John Gray, right, who's an expert on marriage, because he's been married 4 times, I've only been married once. So he says, you can see from the way men and women communicate that they're saying completely different things. Men communicate information. Women communicate to express feelings. It's a whole different type of communication. When you ask a man to do something, he says, no problem. Can you take out the garbage? A man hears, are you man enough to take out the garbage? No problem, Captain. When you ask a woman something, she says, it'll be my pleasure. It's a whole different thing going on over there, you know? So she says to me, you know, I'm dating this guy for 2 years, I fell in love. So what does that mean? It's not my fault. I wasn't planning to fall in love. It happened by itself. It was really a defense that she was offering. And I'm always amazed by that response. Sometimes I'll be halfway through a class on intermarriage and I'll say, how many people now will consider intermarriage? No hands go up. I said, how many of you would consider interdating? All their hands go up. I said, could you explain that one to me? They said, it's only a date. I said, do you know anyone who got married without dating? I said, did any of your parents get married without dating? A guy raises his hand. I said, your parents got married without dating? He says, yeah, they're Hasidic. I said, then what are you doing in an intermarriage class? You know what I mean? You never find Hasidim in church, you know? Do you Feivel Banish hereby take your Christina O'Reilly? Get out! You know? I got to deal with Hasidim. You know? I said, the rest of you, the lip box, you know what I mean? Everybody was left. I said, did any of your parents get married without dating? I said, better yet, did they write in their, you know, appointment book, you know, 3 p.m., fall in love? You know, did they say to their roommates, they're going out with somebody the first time, I think I'll fall in love? Nobody plans on falling in love. What are you going to do if you fall in love? So one of the guys in the audience, because when it comes to relationships, guys are deeper and more emotional. One of the guys says, if I find myself falling in love, I'll break it off. I said, invite me, I want to watch this. Mary O'Reilly, yes, I can never see you again. Why? Because I'm starting to love you. Isn't that nice? No. When I was just using you, that was fine, but I'm starting to develop some actual emotions, so bye! I said, I don't think even you're that shallow. He turns to his friend, he says, what do you think? Yeah, you're that shallow. I could see that, yeah. Anyway, I know I'm into a story, but one of the advantages of ADD is you can say anything you want, you'll make sense. So. Anyway, that's why I became such a successful speaker, because everyone else is going, where are we? Doesn't matter. So, let's work backwards. Anyway, so this girl says to me, so I'm dating this guy for 2 years, and I fall in love. So I said, yeah, because, well, I know I would never intermarry because my Judaism was so important to me. So I said that if she would convert. I told you, people are going to start leaving in twos and threes. Okay, anyway. I have to tell you, the second time in Atlanta, I had the same problem. I'm having too good a time. And it's like, it's your fault. Anyway. So she said, I know I would never intermarry because my Judaism is so important to me. So I told him that if he would convert, I would marry him. It's a typical Jewish response. We don't think anyone else cares about their religion either, you know. So you convert, so no problem. He went. They were conservative, so they found the 6-month conversion course. And in the meantime, she relocated to their city, and they, you know, set up a, joint bank account. They're planning the wedding. The guy is almost through with the course, and he says to her, I can't go through with it. He says, what? He says, I didn't realize that my Catholicism meant so much to me. I didn't realize my mother would be so upset. I can't go through with it. If you want, I'll marry you the way you are. If you're concerned about the kids being confused, you can convert to Catholicism, but I can't go through with this. And she looks at me with tears in her eyes, and she says, and I broke it off. And that's why I'm so emotional. And I said to her, why did you break it off? By the way, in case any of you are considering a career in the rabbinate, that's the wrong answer. Just in case you're taking notes. You're supposed to say, good for you, proud Jew. That's the line they teach us in rabbi school. You understand? I said, why'd you break it off? She says, because my Judaism is so important to me. I said, what does that mean? She says, you know, the holidays. I said, you can be intermarried and have a Passover Seder. You can be intermarried and put an electric menorah in the window. What does it mean? And she says, I'm not sure. I said, well, let me ask you a hard question. And it's a question Jews have had to answer too many times in history. What do you do if somebody pulls out a knife and holds it to your throat and says, Jew, convert or die? What would you do? She thinks about it. She looks at me and she says, I would let myself be killed. And I said to her, never. That's one of those great Yiddish words that you can't translate. It's too bad, it's a pity, it's a nebuch. You know what I mean? I said to her, you broke up with the man you love. You're prepared to die for something, and you don't know what it is. And suddenly I realized that that's what Rashi was bringing the Medrash to explain to us. Because Avraham, for reasons that we are not explaining yet, felt it was worth giving up his life to go into that fire. He felt there was something in this world important enough to die for. And Haran went into that fire because Avraham did. And if we gain nothing this evening but this, I believe it is worthwhile. Do not go into a furnace. It is very hot and you could die. Just want to go on record with that, you know? And yet, you know, if you ask the average Jew today, you can try this on your own, ask the average Jew who's still willing to be affiliated as a Jew, and say, why are you a Jew? Most likely the answer you'll get is, my parents were Jewish. And why were they Jewish? Because their parents were Jewish. And their parents were Jewish. And their parents were Jewish. Tradition! Tradition! And you'll ask me, how did this tradition get started? And I'll tell you, I don't know. That's it. Fiddle on the roof. If you try it. Ask me, why are you Jewish? So you're just Jewish because your parents were Jewish. Right. And if your parents were Catholic, so I'd probably be Catholic. And if your parents were Muslim, I'd probably be Muslim. And if your parents were Nazis, I'd probably be Nazis. I don't like to think too much. Don't confuse me. You understand? I happen to be a Jew because I was born a Jew. Who knows why? It's absolutely amazing. Right? So, this story is, to my mind, somewhat frightening, but it's not very frightening. I'll tell you what I think is a more frightening story. I've been involved in Jewish education for many, many years already, and I was living in the New York area near one of the, you know, large Orthodox synagogues. All of the families who belonged to this synagogue kept Shabbos, kept kosher. It was a very strong community. They all went to the finest yeshiva high schools in the New York area. And like many Orthodox synagogues, they had a youth program. The main purpose of the youth program was to keep the kids out of shul, because otherwise the little children run around and they make noise and they interrupt, and then the parents can't hear themselves talk. Pray. Sorry about that. Pray, of course, is what I meant to say. Anyway. So you get a bunch of teenagers who haven't prayed anyway in about 10 years, and they take the kids downstairs, and they have like puppet shows and relay races, and they give out candies, and everyone's happy. But you got to do something for the teenagers. Now, these teenagers went to the finest yeshiva high schools. They first came home 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. They had a lot of homework, a lot of stuff to do, very busy. Their only downtime in their day was Friday night because, you know, they kept Shabbos, you know. And so what they had, the main activity for them, was basically a social get-together. They called it an Onig Shabbos. It was basically a get-together for the teenagers. But you don't want to present it as just a social event, so you have to bring in a speaker. And these kids want to listen to a speaker on a Friday night like they want all their teeth pulled out without Novocaine. You know what I mean? They're in classes all day. They don't want to hear a speech. So the first speech is always the rabbi of the synagogue. I'm sorry the rabbi left, because I would say this in front of him. I don't want you to think I'm saying anything behind his back. It, of course, does not apply. You know, Rabbi Friedman has nothing to do with him whatsoever. This is a different rabbi. And the rabbi of the synagogue. And, you know that he's, you know, everyone's going to listen to him, because otherwise he'll tell your mother and you get a beating. So the rabbi comes in. And I say by way of introduction, because I've done this over the years in so many different places, and people say, why are you making fun of my rabbi? I said, I don't know your rabbi. I made up this rabbi. I invented him. In fact, I was once in Los Angeles. The rabbi was, they didn't have a rabbi. They asked me to stand in. I just did my imitation of a rabbi. I don't know this rabbi. I made him up. Okay, thank you. So the rabbi comes to speak. Shabbat shalom to all the young people gathered here tonight. This week's Torah portion is a story of the ages. It is a story of courage and of pathos. And it is a story that I believe will touch the lives of all the young people gathered here tonight. And one by one, everyone falls asleep. Now, I don't care what anybody says, because I've been in education for a long time. Girls are just nicer than boys. It's just a fact. You know what I mean? When a girl falls asleep in a class, she always feels guilty. And she pretends that she's thinking. Hey, girls sleep like this in class. Guys have no problem. They just throw their head back. They're not embarrassed at all. No problem, you know? One by one, you see everybody falling asleep, and then the rabbi falls asleep, you know, and around 10 o'clock, the mother wakes everybody up and sends them home. It's a big success, you know, but can't get the rabbi every week. So you have to try to find someone who's going to keep the young people's interest for the allotted amount of time, which is 6 to 8 minutes. If God would reveal himself as he did on Mount Sinai, he could probably get 10, but that's about it. You understand? Top level. 6 to 8, God gets 10, right? Okay. So who do you find? Every community that I've seen who does this program has the same cast of characters, you know? They have a doctor doing research into disgusting diseases. Teenagers love that, you know what I mean? Look at the fungus in his mouth. Is that horrible? Here, pass that around, you know? Look at how that leg blew up. Is that horrible, you know? Here, I brought an actual human hand. Pass that around, you know? You know? That's good. Young people like that. That's the... They'll have some lawyer speak about some case in the news that nobody really cares about, but everyone will pretend to listen because they're going to probably ask this guy for a job one day, you know what I mean? So they pretend to listen, you know. They'll have a local business leader come in and speak about business ethics and other oxymorons, like military intelligence. But it's about March. They've used up just about everybody in the community. They brought in somebody to speak about his recent trip to Romania. Always a crowd pleaser for teenagers. The synagogues in Bucharest have sort of like a Muslim influence. You know what I'm saying? A Muslim influence. With like domes, you know, like a Muslim. And the kids are like, make it stop now! No more Muslims! So they tell them, oh, you're at that one, huh? Anyway, you know, they say to the youth director, one more like that, we're never coming back. You know what I mean? So I see the youth director, and he says to me, hey, you know, could you do me a favor? I said, what? He says, I'd like you to be the sacrificial speaker at the Oneg. I said, I'd rather give you a kidney. He says, because you don't get off so easy, he says. I said, I don't want to do this. Nobody wants to hear me. He says, I know. You have 6 to 8 minutes. Just get it over with and get out of there. And like, you know, I said, fine. Okay, all these things that work the same way. They call it for 8 o'clock. One boy shows up at 8 o'clock, Myron. Another one whose trousers don't quite reach his shoes, you know, hair parted in the middle, you know, voice hasn't finished changing yet, you know. He stays in the kitchen all night helping the mother refill the refreshments, you know. Can I bring out more chips, Mrs. Harris? Okay, you know. Everybody else is waiting outside because if you show up too early, everyone knows you have no life. You know what I'm saying? It can be 40 degrees below zero and hailing and everyone's huddled together. So there's enough people that everybody walks in and they put on the excited teenage look, I would rather be anywhere than here, you know? And they introduce me and I know I got to work fast. So I say to these kids the following. I'm going to put 2 buttons in front of you. Push the button on your left and you'll wake up tomorrow morning a nice kid in a nice family, same socioeconomic level that you're in now, but you will never have been Jewish. Push the button on your right and you'll stay the way you are. I said, my guess is that if I went around to yeshiva high schools and offered them this chance, 60% of the kids would push the button on the left and choose not to be Jewish. Yeah, this is what we do with teenagers. Confrontation, discussion, you know what I'm saying? And they all just look at me. Nothing, no one's speaking. I said, what is it? They said, Rabbi, how can you talk to us like that? Everybody would push the button on the left. Okay, so it's a Friday night. I'm in a room full of yeshiva kids who would all rather be Christian. So I said, why is that? Now, of course, that's not fair because I'm asking teenagers to think, which is not what we train them to do. We train them to listen carefully and repeat exactly what we said, preferably in the same exact words. That's what high school is all about. Every teenager knows you never give your opinion. You look at the adult and you figure out what they want you to say. And they're always sizing you up. I was once in a high school where some kids were cheating on a test. I know it's hard to believe. And the principal came in and said, I can't believe that people are cheating on a test. Do you know why you shouldn't cheat on tests? Yes, because we're only cheating ourselves. The sincerity brought a tear to my eye. It was so funny. We're only cheating ourselves. I don't have to tell you that. I work in yeshivas and seminaries in Israel. You know, people come for their interviews. Everybody has something. Why do you want to come here? I'm looking for a place where I can grow. Everyone says the same line. You don't want some places that, well, I'm looking for a place with the latest curfew. A party. Anyway, I want to grow. So they're looking at me, you know. So I said, why is that? Why don't you want to be Jewish? So they're trying to figure out, okay, what does he want us to say? I said, I'll help you. It's obvious. You hate being Jewish. Oh, you can't say that. It might be true, but you can't say it. So one girl raised her hand. She says, not true. I love keeping Shabbos. It's the only day I get to sleep. You know, there's a lot in that line, if you think about it. I once heard a yeshiva kid trying to describe the perfect Shabbos. You know, you wait for your dad to come home from shul. You know, you eat, you know, the meal quickly. Dad falls asleep at the table reading the paper. You know, and like around November time, like you could be in bed by 6 o'clock. Oh, it's great. You know, you just lie there, you know. It's like being dead, you know. You wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning in a panic. Oh no, I hope I will be able to fall asleep. Go to the kitchen, have a little snack, go back to sleep. Get up late, catch the end of davening, you know, come home, eat lunch, get in another nap. And before you know it, it's over. What a spiritual odyssey. My goodness. What a beautiful Shabbos. So I said, look, I don't know how to explain this to you, but non-Jews can just take the phone off the hook and take a nap. She was devastated. I took away her only reason she had for being Jewish. I said, what is it that you guys like about being Jewish? I know, because there's so many things you can't eat. No, I know, because there's so much stuff you can't do on Saturday. No, I know, because you love learning Gemara. No, I know, because you've hit... Okay, you're right, we hate it. Everybody hate it? You know, we all hate it. I said, now we're getting somewhere. Everybody hates it, right? So why don't you give it up? Why don't you fix this? Here's the answer. Our parents make us. Why? Because their parents made them. Their parents made them. And their parents made them. Tradition! I don't know what it's here in Atlanta, but my brother just told me that they're paying for their yeshiva education $20,000 a year tuition. That means that was about, you know, $250,000 of Jewish education to get the same answer that I'm getting from a girl with no Jewish education wrestling with intermarriage. When you ask the single most fundamental question, why are you a Jew? Why should you do this? The answer I get is because. Because. I was born Jewish. That's it. And that's it. And I don't know why everybody else has done it. That's it. But if you press people, but why should you do it? So I looked at my watch and said, okay, you know, 8 minutes are up. I'm not God. My time is done. They said, whoa, wait a second, Rabbi. We know the deal. You can confuse us and challenge us, but in the last 2 minutes, you have to give us a self-satisfying answer so we can forget we've ever seen you. You know what I'm saying? Don't leave me with any sense of discomfort that I have to think. You know what I'm saying? I said, well, you've all had a Jewish education. Think for a minute. Why do you have to be Jewish? Why do you have to follow the Torah? Why do you have to do this? They're looking at each other. One guy raises his hand and says, I know why. Why? Because otherwise God will burn you in hell. Now there's the first positive thought I had. Exactly. God will burn you in hell forever. That works. I was speaking in Israel once to one of these yeshivas for the religiously challenged. And this guy was like second year, so he was more or less sober. And I said, so what happens when you die? He says, you know, you go to the next world, you go to Umaba. I said, what's that like? He says, it's like a beach, you know, and a cold beer. He continued developing the picture. I'm sure you can work it out for yourself. Suffice it to say, it was closer to the Muslim conception than the Jewish conception. I said, is that what you really believe? That heaven's going to be like? He says, no, I wish. I said, so what is it really? He says, you sit on a cloud and you play a harp. I said, do you like harp music? He says, not particularly. I said, so what are you going to do? He says, I'll get an electric harp. Put my halo on sideways. Rocking on cloud nine. I said, okay. I said, are you bad? He says, then God burns you in hell forever. I said, and you're comfortable with that picture? He says, yeah. I said, you know what it's like? It's like a father comes into his daughter's room and says, sweetheart, your room is a mess. It's bad for you. It's bad for us. If you clean it up, I'll buy you a new outfit and take you out for dinner. And if you don't, I'll break your arm and beat you till you're bloody. I said, what would you do? He says, I'd call social services. The man is insane. I said, but that's how you picture God. If you're good, you get a cloud in the harp. And if you're bad, you burn in hell forever. Our dysfunctional father who art in heaven. I asked somebody once, I said, how do you picture God? He says, a big frowning face in the sky saying, I'm going to get you. Oh, come on. We all know this. We don't like to talk about it. We all know it. That's that joyous time of year, the high holidays. Oh, goody. My family only went to synagogue on the high holidays. My father would make us put on a suit and drag us, you know, to shul, you know, and we'd stand there. And I had no idea what was going on, you know. And I couldn't believe what was going on. And I would just count the pages. 800 pages. Never going to make it. And then one year I realized half of them are in English. It's only 400 pages. We'll be out of here in no time. Let me see. The guy's been on this word for about 15 minutes. I don't think we go home till Hanukkah. But if you can just stay in synagogue long enough, God forgave all your sins. You know, that's how it worked, you know? But then you get older, and you actually start to follow along with the prayers, you know? And then it gets much worse. Then it gets really big. We come to one of the major prayers, which was Nisana Tokev. You know? I knew this was an important part, because my father would always say, where's the place? And I never knew where the place was. Because every cantor has a trick where they spend 15 minutes on a word, and then they go, mana, 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 and you're flipping. We had one of those page counters in my shul, but you know, Yom Kippur always comes out like around the World Series, and somebody would put up the score. You only turn the page if there was a home run, otherwise you stay right where you were. My father's like, follow along, this is important. And the cantor would get up to sing. Mi yichye u'mi yamos. Now, Chazonis is subtle. He tried to be able to communicate ideas with music. And essentially what he was saying is, someone may live, but you're gonna die. And the choir goes, die, 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 die. And everyone in the congregation is like, I'm gonna die? Oh man, what a bummer, you know? But it's not over yet. Now you get to pick the way you're gonna go. You understand? Who by fire? Who by water? Everyone's thinking, well, fire's kind of hot, you know. I could probably tread water for a while, you know. Who by storm and who by sword? I saw the Wizard of Oz. Storm's not so bad. We go with that, you know. Who by earthquake and who by pestilence? I don't know. What is pestilence? Never heard of anyone dying. We'll take the pestilence, Bob, you know. But the message seems to be pretty clear, and that is, you're going to die a horrible death, because God hates you, you miserable sinner, unless you repent. Repent! Get down on your hands and knees and crawl on your stomach, cry and beg, and then you could get off with a serious illness. That's why this is such a joyous time of year. Dad, what's with the apple and honey? First sweet year, if we make it. How does it look? Doesn't look good. Yom Kippur came out on a Wednesday. I know I'm all dressed up in a suit and I'm going to synagogue, you know. And my neighbor is not Jewish. He says, Dave, where are you going? I have to go to synagogue today and afflict myself. Oh, yeah, why? Because I'm evil. Oh, all right. Will I see you tomorrow? I have no idea. Any word on the pestilence? I should have taken an earthquake. What was I doing? Never get earthquakes around here. No, when you consider that most Jews only go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Are you surprised there's such a high assimilation rate? I'm shocked anybody's left. But this is it. God hates you, you miserable sinner, you're going to burn in hell, you know? I had once when I was in yeshiva. I life imitates art. I was in yeshiva. I was in the doldrums, you know. I was a little down, you know. And he wanted to get me back into things. And he says, come on, David, you have to show up. You have to come. You have to work harder. And I said, Rebbe, what's the point? I'm just going to go to hell anyway. He said, that's true. But he saw that I was down and he wanted to cheer me up. So he says, focus on the following. At 350 degrees, you bake. But at 400, you burn. Boy, did I feel better. That meant that if I daven three times a day and I learned and I did everything I was supposed to do at the end, I would just bake. And I wouldn't broil. Yeah, that really is a real pick-me-up. Boy, that put a spring in my step. You know what I mean? But this is it. So that's it. This is where we are today. Okay? This is the reality. If you ask the average Jew why you were Jew, they say, I was born that way. I don't know why. I was born that way. You know? And if you find someone with a little more education, they'll tell you you're going to burn in hell. And that's it. Right? Now, by the way, I've given you the best answers. There are also some not such good answers. These are the best answers that there are. Here are some much worse answers, you know? Because the Jews have made so many wonderful contributions to society. So did the Etruscans. Then they moved out of the way and made room for somebody else, you know? We lost so many Jews in the Holocaust. Yes. And if there won't be any Jews left, who will they kill the next time? I know that argument never really worked with me. That's supposed to be the argument why you should assimilate. That doesn't sound like I should stick around, you know? We have to preserve Jewish culture. Why? Because otherwise it will die. Why? Because nobody likes it. That's why. Do you find Italians paying people to eat lasagna? No, people like lasagna. But you have to pay people to eat gefilte fish because otherwise they keep thinking, what is that goo in the jar? We don't really want to think about it, you know? But if you pay us, we'll go to a Jewish cultural event, listen to klezmer, dance to horror, and eat gefilte fish. And I say, if nobody likes it, let it die. If that's the only reason we're trying to keep this around, here's another great one. We've been around for so long. Oh, I'm sorry, was there some ancient people contest I entered I wasn't aware of? Who are we still running against? Give us the award and let's move on, you know what I mean? But this is it. Which means the most fundamental question, the most important question that a person can ask, why should I be a Jew? No one has an answer. And I have to tell you the truth. We live in very difficult times. Because every census shows the same thing. The fastest growing group in the Jewish people is not Reform, it's not conservative, it's not Orthodox, it's not New Age, it's not Reconstructionist. The fastest growing group is disaffiliated. Every census, more and more Jews just drop out. That's where we're going. You know, and if you want to try to hold people in, you're going to have to give them a good answer. And if you say to them, well, you were born Jewish, so? So don't you feel an obligation? No. But we've been doing this for thousands of years. Okay, so I'm the first smart Jew in thousands of years, you know? Yeah, but if you don't do this, then you're going to burn in hell. I don't believe in hell. Then you'll really burn in hell. I'll take my chances. And this is only this generation. This is where we're at. We are at the most dramatic point in Jewish history. There hasn't been a more dramatic point. When I was growing up, anybody who's in my age group, if I would have said to my mother, why do I have to be a Jew? She would have given me a simple theological response. Shut up, stupid. And you know what? It would have worked for me. If it got really bad, my father would say, you want to be in the will? I said, I don't know, how much are we talking about? Okay, that's worth it. Today, people don't care. They say, I can make my own money on the internet, I don't need you. You know? Well, why should I be a Jew? And suddenly everybody has to confront the fact that we don't know. This is the simplest question that a person has to answer. And these are the answers that are out there, and clearly these are not the answers. Clearly these answers are wrong. Mark Twain used to say, when all else fails, try the truth. So I would like to give you the true answer that the Jewish people have always given when they ask the question, why should we be a Jew? This is the answer that's always been around. I'm going to quote from a particular source, Masilas Yesharim, which was translated into English as The Path of the Just. It's in a lot of different places, but as it happens, I give an ongoing shiur on this, and the shiurim are downloadable from my website, rabbiorlovsky.com, which is the reason I'm quoting from that particular work, because this is not really a shiur, this is an infomercial. So, where was I? Rabbiorlovsky.com, right, that's where I was at. But anyway, the Matilas Yesharim is a work that was written by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto in the early 1700s. The purpose of the book is to teach you how to become perfect. I've finished it a number of times. I got stuck once on humility, but once I got that down, no problem, you know? The rest was easy. It's an unbelievable book. It talks about spiritual greatness. The highest levels are divine inspiration and the power to resurrect the dead. I don't want to show off. But this is what we're talking about. You think about the highest levels of spirituality. I want to share with you the first two lines in the first chapter. That's it. Yisod HaChassidus v'Shorash HaAvodah Tamimihi. She is Yisbar v'Yisamis into Adam Ma'a Chavos Ba'olamo. The foundation of religiosity. The root of all divine service. That means, before you go anywhere, whatever you're going to do, if you're going to have any kind of spirituality, any kind of Jewish life, it's all going to rest on this one idea. Why are you alive? Such a simple question, so difficult to answer. I was talking to a group of young men in their 20s, about marriage. I said, you know, when you get married, you have to make sure you have the same goals in life. Do any of you yet know what your goals in life are? So a guy raises his hand. He says, yeah, I do. So what's your goal in life? I'm going to be a dentist. I said, that's not your goal in life. He says, sure it is. I said, no, it's not. He says, I'm in dental school. I said, I'll prove it to you. He says, go ahead. I said, you're 70, 80, 90, 100 years old. You're on your deathbed. They're writing your eulogy. You get to listen in. He was a dentist. He filled many cavities. He removed many impacted teeth. He was very good with molars. The guy says, stop. I said, no, I'm getting to the best part. Your tombstone is a big tooth. And I said, here lies a dentist. The guy says, no, 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 you didn't understand what I meant. I said, oh, I misunderstood you? He says, yeah, I didn't mean my goal in life is to be a dentist. I meant I want to earn my living from dentistry. I said, oh, I misunderstood. That's not your goal. Right. So what's your goal in life? He says, I have no idea. I always told people I want to be a dentist, and everyone said, good for you. Because everybody receives the same recipe for a successful life. Go to university, learn a profession, get a job, make money, get married, buy a house, have kids, happy life. Now you're 45. You've got everything. Now what do you do? Now, get old and die. We have nothing else for you to do. Some people figure out they have enough time to play twice. They divorce their wife, they get married again, they have new kids, get a new job, you know, and they go around the board two times. You know, that's also an option, you know. Most people are content just to have a midlife crisis. They suddenly wake up and they're like, oh my gosh, I'm an accountant, I live in the suburbs, I don't know if I ever want to get married, I have to find myself. You know, they get themselves a little sports car, they have to have somebody help them into it because they're not so comfortable. You know, sometimes you get to see these people out on the dance floor, you know, barely alive. Barely alive. Hey, that's a great move. No, no, it's my back. Yeah, it's pretty depressing. Eventually they give it up, they're content just to be old. They start wearing their pants up to here. Get the orthopedic sneakers, take 3 minutes to sit in the chair, and fall asleep a lot. Fall asleep in the middle of a conversation, fall asleep reading the paper, fall asleep watching TV, and they always deny it. Oh, I'm sorry, you were sleeping? No, no, no. I'll talk to you later. No, I'm up. When you get to be my mother's age, she's 82, you reach the ultimate status symbol, which is comparing medication with other elderly people. You take that, I take it too. How much? I asked you first. 60? I take 80. Ah! I'm sicker than you are. The more medical science struggles to keep us alive, the more inherently valuable we are. So this is the first question. Why are you alive? Did you see how hard this is to answer for people? I had given this this idea over once, and someone said to me, I heard this someplace. I said, where? He said, I'll find it. And he sends me a recording from a movie with Billy Crystal, City Slickers. City Slickers. And he's talking to his kid's third grade class. And he says to the kids in third grade, enjoy this time of your life. It's the best part. Your 20s are a blur. Your 30s, you get married, you have a couple of kids. You say, what happened to my 20s? Your 40s, start to lose your hair. You grow another chin. One of your old girlfriends from high school becomes a grandmother. 50s, you can't go out anymore because the music's too loud. You'll have a minor operation. You'll call it a procedure, but it's an operation. 60s, you'll have a major operation. The music's still too loud, but you can't hear it anyway. 70s, you and the wife retire to Florida. Start having supper 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Lunch 10 o'clock in the morning. Breakfast the night before. You walk around malls looking for the ultimate frozen yogurt saying, how come the kids don't call? 80s, you have a stroke. You get taken care of by a Jamaican woman that your wife can't stand and you call mama. And that's it. That is life. That's how we... This is how, if you stop to look at it, it sounds too depressing. We don't like to look at that, you know? But, you know, that's why when we're young, everything looks so great, you know? We're working towards our goals, then we get there, and then we don't know what to do after that because we just planned our lives till 40, 50. Then what do? Then what are we supposed to do for the rest of our lives? 70, 80, 90, please God. You know, science is getting better and better, keeping us around. You know, what are we supposed to do for the rest of our lives, for the second half of our lives? Why are you alive? Why are you in this world? What are we doing here? So, here is his answer. Masha Harono Chacham Zechono LeBrachu, what the sages of blessed memory taught us, and he's saying, this has always been the Jewish response, is that a person was only created for one reason, Lehis'aneg al Hashem, to get pleasure from God, v'lehenos mizim shechinasai, and enjoy the light of his Shechina, because that is the greatest pleasure and delight that there is. I read this to a group of yeshiva students once. I said, what did he say? Why are we alive? They said, to serve God. Nope, he didn't say that. Listen again. We were created to get pleasure from God and enjoy the divine light because that's the greatest pleasure and delight that there is. Why are we in this world? To get the divine light. Wrong. I heard divine light. Now listen to the whole sentence. We're here to get pleasure from God and enjoy the divine light because that's the greatest pleasure and delight that there is. In other words, let's put it into an equation. We were created for X because X is the greatest pleasure and delight that there is. But if you could convince me that Y is the greatest pleasure, that's where we're created. Z, that's why. God created us for one reason, to get the greatest possible pleasure. Party till you die and the party keeps going. That's it. That's the only reason we're in this world. I can't speak for anybody else. No one ever told me that in my Jewish education. We are in this world to do mitzvahs. Now we eat a matzah. Now we make a bracha. Put the tzedakah in the tzedakah box. Push the button. Pull the lever. Do the mitzvah. That's it. That's why we're here. That's not what he says. That has never been the Jewish response. God is infinite. In scientific terms, that's very big. As such, he doesn't need anything. He doesn't need you to pray to him. He doesn't need you to eat kosher. He created the world for you to get the greatest possible pleasure. That's it. The only hard part is to figure out what the greatest pleasure is. Because the world is filled with pleasures. There's no question about it. Those of us who, you know, have abused our bodies in our youth so that now in our middle age, we have to take better care of it if we want it to stick around with us, you know. So we know there's lots of food out there that we cannot eat. Not because the food is not tasty and not yummy and not enjoyable and it will make us happy. But only for a short time. So we look at it and we say, it's not bad, it's a pleasure.
but staying alive is a greater pleasure. So I'm not going to eat it. Right? Everybody is going to look at the world, and the world is filled with pleasures, and it's a question of what is the greatest pleasure? What is the greatest pleasure? Because the world is filled with pleasure, and you can't have it all. You want to travel the world, and I know people want to travel the world, that's beautiful. But you'll never have the pleasure of being part of a community. You want to flip from relationship to relationship, you can do that. But you'll never know what it is to have a long-term marriage. That's a whole different pleasure. You know, you want to, work day and night in your career, you won't be able to have a relationship with your kids. It's going to be a question of choosing between pleasures. What's going to be the greatest pleasure? Because the world is filled with good things. And it's not a question of choosing between good and evil. It's a question of choosing between what is the greatest possible pleasure. And let's speak frankly. Every single person who has the opportunity to have an infidelity with somebody at work, which comes up every single day. If they choose not to, it's not because they decided to suffer, it's because they decided that their marriage was a greater pleasure to them. And I met people who made the wrong decision, you know, and they lost their marriage. And I said to them, what were you thinking? And they said, I wasn't thinking. If I was thinking it through, if I realized what I really wanted, because, you know, some people are not going for the greatest, I shouldn't say that. Most people don't go for the greatest pleasure. They go for the easiest, fastest, quickest pleasure. Right? Anything that's easily available is what we take. That, otherwise, why would anyone play solitaire on the computer? You don't have to admit it. You understand? You don't really play solitaire on the computer. You're waiting for your email to download, whatever it is, and you flip it on. And, okay, you don't have to shuffle the deck, and you can change the backs, you know. But you watch someone who gets caught in solitaire, it's horrible to watch, you know. Look, your best friend just came to visit. Uh-huh. We're going out for dinner. Uh-huh. The house is on fire. Uh-huh. And they just keep playing, because at the end, they get to watch the cards kiss. And this is how you know you have no life. You watch all the cards. Here come the twos and the aces. Do you want to play again? I didn't really want to play the first time. Now watch someone who's been playing solitaire for like an hour. How do they come out? Refreshed? Invigorated? No, they're already dead. They're just missing the box, you know? They're like, I can't believe I just spent an hour doing that. Why? Because it's easy. Because it's easy. That's why so many people now, instead of having to have real relationships, talk in chat rooms anonymously to other people that they'll never see. You are my best friend. Big W. I don't even know who this person is. You know what I mean? Doesn't make a difference. He's my best friend, you know? And because anytime I want, I just click off the computer. There's no investment in that, you know? But those who are married know it takes a lot more time to invest in a real relationship. Anything that's good takes more time. You want to go out to eat three nights a week? That's beautiful. What if you want to save up money for a down payment on a house? So I may have to cut that out for something better. I'm going to have to stop now in order to be able to look ahead at a greater pleasure. It's going to take more time to invest. Maybe I'll get a better return. So the world is filled with pleasures. And if you look over the pleasures, obviously the greatest pleasure is an infinite pleasure. An infinite pleasure is a pleasure that just gets better and better and better and better. We have no frame of reference for this, unfortunately. Right? To us, a pleasure is pretzels. How many pretzels can you eat while it's still an enjoyable experience? 3, maybe 4. You know, then your teeth get covered with pretzel gunk. Everyone you eat tastes like nothing. And that's why you see everybody has this love-hate relationship with pretzels. They push it away and they pull it back. And they keep crying, thinking it's going to get better, and it never does. But imagine a bag of pretzels where you never got full, and the bag never ran out, and your teeth never got covered with pretzel gunk, and each one tasted better than the one before. And then that's called an infinite pleasure. It just gets better and better and better, and you never run out. An infinite pleasure would be the greatest pleasure. Says Masilas Yesharim, you know, we were created to get pleasure from God and enjoy the divine light, because that's the greatest pleasure. You know why? Because it's infinite. It gets better and better and better. I have to tell you, when I have said over this idea, very often people who are mitzvah observant come over to me and say, well, Rabbi, I haven't felt that. You know why? Because no one ever told us that was the purpose. Of course, if you spend so much time on the on the form, you're going to miss the substance? Of course, if people knew that's the reason we keep all of the mitzvahs are there for one reason, to get us this unbelievable spirituality. Take keeping kosher, right? Why do you keep kosher? This is my favorite one. People say, you know, well, you keep kosher for health reasons. It's hygiene. They've obviously never been in a kosher restaurant. You know what I mean? Many things you can say. You know what I'm saying? But that's not one of them, you know? That's not the, obviously it's not the reason. You know what I mean? What's the reason? The Torah says, the reason is because it opens you up to spirituality. There are diets that give you energy. There are diets that help you think. This is a diet that opens you up to spirituality. That's it. God said, eat these foods and you'll be more receptive to spirituality. Period. That's why we do it. All the mitzvahs are there to help us get this life, to get this unbelievable experience where we're living out of this world. What does that mean? I had a friend of mine who was going to England. If anyone's ever been to England, you'll be able to relate to this. He says, I was flying and the sky was blue and the sun was shining. And I went beneath the clouds. And I was in England for a week. And I never saw the sun. Right? You've been to England? Very impossible. You could be there for a whole week, you never see the sun. It's always dark and drizzly. That's why English people are the way they are. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that's who they are as people. Their national personality. I read an article in the New York Times 15 years ago that McDonald's had to change their international policy in England. Because every country in the world, and whatever their language is, when you give them the change, you have to say, thank you, have a nice day. And this was infuriating Englishmen, because they didn't want to have a nice day, and they resented being told to. So in England, you don't have to say it anymore. Just hand them the change and say, right then. Right. Okay. The guy's there for a week, it's dark, it's drizzly, and he finally gets on the plane. He gets up above the clouds, and suddenly he sees the sky is blue and the sun is shining. And I said to him, the sky was always blue, and the sun was always shining. You just didn't know how to get above the clouds. And the whole purpose of Judaism is to teach us how to get above the clouds. To live in a world that is bright and sunny when everyone else is living in a world that is dark and drizzly and gray. We are supposed to be able to live with this sense, with this light that comes from being close to God. That's it. All the mitzvahs are there for only that purpose. If we miss that, we miss having this connection to God, to have this unbelievable spiritual power from this divine light. We missed everything. The purpose is not to do mitzvahs. I had a guy in North America once, he asked me, he says, where's all the joy that comes in Judaism? I said, it comes from being close to God, getting that unbelievable pleasure when you feel the spiritual pleasure. He goes, well, I don't know if I believe in God. I said, then I have nothing to offer you. You want to eat a matzah, eat a matzah. You want to shake a lulav, shake a lulav. That's not what Judaism is about. It's not about ritual. We're not doing things to find ways to keep ourselves busy. Every mitzvah has the purpose of connecting us to this unbelievable spiritual pleasure so that bit by bit, you can lift yourself out of this world and live in a world which is unbelievably spiritual and deep and beautiful. The tragedy is, in the Federation of Philadelphia, they brought in Buddhist monks to teach the rabbis and lay leaders how to introduce spirituality into the prayer service. The guy who was running the Or Smith branch there, when he saw this, he made a series of classes called Judah Without Buddha. You know? But let's face it, a guy comes in, a Buddhist monk comes in and says, I'll teach you how to meditate and reach Nirvana. And everyone's like, wow. And a rabbi comes in and says, you want to learn how to daven with kavanah? What's that? You know what I mean? Because we never saw it. To us it's Adonai Olam Hashem Olach Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecho Yaluch Hazala. Yeah, and you know, and where's the spirituality? We don't see it because nobody ever taught us. That's what Torah and Mitzvot is all about. Only that. To be able to lift ourselves up and get this unbelievable pleasure. I want to finish up, and they say an optimist is somebody who, when the rabbi says, in conclusion, they put their shoes back on. But I want to finish up with two ideas. The first one is that the Russian Minister of Education asked Rav Chaim Volozhin, at what age do you Jews start educating the children? And he said, 20 years before they're born. It's a powerful idea, because we can only give over what we've got. If we don't have it, what are we going to give? You know, we have to know for ourselves. We have to find the meaning for ourselves to be able to pass it on. When my father passed away, as the rabbi of the family, I was asked to write the inscription. And I'm a Kohen. I had never really been to a cemetery before. And I wanted to write something special for my father. My father grew up with no Jewish education. He didn't become Shomer Shabbos until he was 67 years old. And he sacrificed to send his kids to yeshiva so that they had a Jewish education. You know, I remember, my mother said to me, it was a hard time for us because we had gone bankrupt in the business. And the times were really hard. I said, when did Dad go bankrupt? He goes, right around when you were born. Every child brings their own luck, he said to me. But it was a hard time, and my parents really sacrificed to be able to send us, to get us a yeshiva education, you know. And he left behind 38 grandchildren who are all being brought up in Jewish tradition. All those who are of age are going to yeshiva. It's quite an accomplishment when I look at certain branches of the family that have just vanished as Jews altogether, you know. So I wanted to write something special, and it was taking me a long time to put it together. And my brother wanted to put up the stone already and have the unveiling, and I said, I'm working on it. And he says, how long does it take to write a tombstone? I said, it takes a lifetime to write a tombstone. And I have to put it down into words now. And I need a little time. Because we're now living the life we're going to look back at. And most people, and it's for sure true, the way we want to be remembered after we're gone is seldom the way we actually live our lives. Nobody really wants, at the end of their life, to be remembered what their life was. You know? A mafia hitman. You think what they want to say at his funeral? You know, Vinny, he was a great killer. He killed lots of people, and always in creative ways. I remember one time they had this guy by the throat, you know? They don't want to say that. They'll say at his funeral, Vinny, he was good to his mother. Vinny, he was a loyal friend. You know, they'll find something good to say because nobody, you know, it's amazing. You know, if we only said about it, you know, us what our lives are. So why don't we live those lives that we want to look back on? Why aren't we big? Why aren't we noble? It's only one reason. We're not looking ahead. We're not looking to the end. We're just making the next decision. We're playing the solitaire on the computer. We're doing the easy instead of the meaningful. We're not going for the best life we can live. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not put us in this world. God didn't create us to get a pleasure. He created us to get the greatest pleasure. There's lots of pleasures. But trust me, if you realize you could have gotten a better pleasure, you will be very disappointed. Those of you who are old enough to remember a game show called Let's Make a Deal, and at the end there are three doors. Pick a door. Door number two. You sure? Yeah. You want to switch? No. I'll give you $1,000 to switch. No. Okay? Door number two. But first, what's behind door number one? A new car. Ah! And park it in the garage of your new house. Ah! You didn't take door number one. Door number three. A Caribbean vacation. Ooh. Fly there in your own plane. Ah! And live on your own island. Ah! Didn't take that. Door number two. It's a year's supply of toilet paper. Okay. Okay. It's worth a few $100, you know what I mean? I didn't pay anything to get on the show. What's the big deal? So how come the guy wants to kill himself? You know what I'm saying? Because when he realizes what he could have had. So when people say, well, you know, I'm okay. That's only because you don't realize what you could have had. Nobody wants an okay life. Those of you who are single, you know this for sure. They'll say to you, I got a great girl for you. Tell me about her. She's okay. Nothing special. Good enough for you. What, you were so exceptional? Trust me. Trust me, it's fine. We don't want to hear that. We want to hear we're getting the best. Why, are you the best? That's not the point. We want the best of everything. We want the best of everything. When we turn around and realize what's behind the other two doors, and we realize we settled for nothing. We settled for something so small. When you can have this spiritual pleasure that just gets better and better and better, that lifts us out of this world, that's what Judaism has always been about. We Jews have been accused of a lot. They called us, you know, that we killed their God. We tortured the wafer. They used to kill Jews for cookie torture. You know, we drink children's blood. They called us everything they can think of. There's only one thing they never called us. Stupid. Only thing we Jews have never been accused of. We've been around for a long time. We've been around for a long time for one reason. Because we have something really special. Sometimes I have these students come to Israel and they say to me, Rabbi, you're the biggest challenge to my secular lifestyle. I say, really, which class did I give? He says, it's none of your classes, I don't listen. I said, so then what is it? He goes, I'm living this secular lifestyle and I can do whatever I want. And you're living this restrictive lifestyle and I can't help but feel you're having more fun in life than I am. I said, kills you, doesn't it? I said, that's right, I didn't grow up in Borough Park. I grew up in a nice conservative synagogue in Long Island. I had my bar mitzvah, I read Heavenly Father, today I am a man. I stand here in the fight of my parents and my grandparents. I found that there's something unbelievable out there. When people look at you and they say, wow, he's got something special, she's got something special. When our kids come to us and say, why should we be a Jew? And we can say, because we've got something better than everything that's out there. And we have an answer to give to our children and to our grandchildren when they ask us, why should we be a Jew? And then, hopefully, we will go through this generation into the next generation where the Jewish people will come out stronger and, please God, enter into the era of Mashiach the way we should. Thank you very much.